I'm here in this beautiful English mansion competing with 11 other American girls.
That's actually 10. Tiffany died.
Really? How?
Apparently it's possible to overdose on bronzer.
Anyway, we're competing to win the love of this guy who, a lot of the girls think he's Prince Harry, but I'm not so sure. Yesterday, he told us his whole plan for this reality show.
To do your own TV show, it takes, you gotta pitch it. You gotta pitch it. It takes money. There's gotta be some way to, like, do it quick, do it easy. Then I could take it to, a network and, pitch it.
It's just that in the pictures I've seen, Prince Harry looks so much cuter.
I always read descriptions of, snaggletooth, bug-eyed. Okay.
I really think it is Harry, and I think I'm going to win. Although right now, he seems more interested in Kyone. Yesterday, she told him he could send her an email.
You know what? You're right. And I have an AOL account, so...
I'm not here to make friends. Let's face it, Kyone is a skank and a bitch and a weirdo slut loser freak. And...
I'm a little skeptical. If this really is Prince Harry, I think he might be sick or something.
There is no medicine for what I have.
Doesn't he look like somebody else? Like that guy who was in Fargo? And Armageddon and The Big Lebowski?
I don't know. I only go to movies to, check out the makeup.
This could be my fairy tale. But even if he doesn't choose me, I'm gonna go back to my old life. And someday I'll find my real Prince Charming.
It might be hard to go back to the way things used to be. I mean, I do think the landscape has changed.
She's a beast and a sea donkey. She's a skeezy hoe. She's a woofer and a yak. And also...
Okay, we have to stop because this music is driving me nuts. But today on the show, The Nose breaks down the new reality show I Wanna Marry Harry, plus literature at Chipotle, and Iran's crackdown on happiness. And now the producers keep saying he's Lord Mountbatten, but I think he's Colin McEnroe.
All right. Was everybody clear about the fact that was the voice of Steve Buscemi, or did that just go over people's heads?
It took me till the second time to figure it out.
I knew who it was right away.
What's a sea donkey?
I was as the writer, I can tell you, I was after a while. You can't say skank more than once, yeah. And I was running. I don't watch enough reality television to know what they call each other. So
I think it's an Iranian skank.
But feel free to use it. Over the course of the Memorial Day weekend.
Hashtag
call somebody a hashtag sea donkey. All right, so we already lost control of the flow of the show. Rand Cooper is here, a writer, novelist, short story writer, restaurant reviewer for the New York Times. And many other things as well. You can say the same about Jim Chapdelaine, a guitar hero, a producer, a winner of many, many Emmys. Teresa Kraber is here with us. She runs The Cut. She founded The Cut, which is a website devoted to exploring and celebrating the idiocies of Connecticut. Or the ridiculousnesses?
I don't care because don't now care. I'm just retitling it The Sea Donkey.
The Sea Donkey. Yeah. It's actually
be your nom de plume.
The website formerly known as The Cut. Now,
I think it's the intricacies of Connecticut, isn't it?
The Connecticut Sea Donkey.
It was the idiocies, okay.
Yeah. Something.
The state animals.
I think it is ridiculousness.
So we don't do a lot with reality television on this. On the nose, mainly because none of us actually watch reality television. Jacques does. Jacques is the only person. Jacques told us all about Honey Boo Boo well before the world knew about Honey Boo Boo. And I'm also assuming most of our listeners, being public radio people, they don't watch reality television either. But this week, Katie Tularsky, who appeared in that intro, by the way, steered us towards something called I Want to Marry Harry. It's on Fox right now. It had its first episode this week. A British man named Matt Hicks, who kind of resembles Prince Harry, impersonates him for 12 American women. They think they're on a dating show. They think it might be Harry, and he sort of doesn't exactly say one way or another. Willa Paskin at Slate called it the most brazenly morally bankrupt reality show to air on network television since the lawless years of the early aughts. And Laurie Penny in the British New Statesman, it's going to air in Britain. It hasn't started yet. Writes, the idea is simple. 12 impressionable, classically attractive, and heavily made-up young women are flown to a stately home in Berkshire and introduced to a young toff. He has a security detail and looks a lot like Prince Harry. And they are encouraged to compete for the affections of Harry in the age-old North American mating ritual, a series of humiliating rounds of hazing in which each contestant's emotional journey is edited for the maximum schadenfreude and broadcast to an audience of millions. Now, some might argue that the concept of this series is not only the worst thing Fox has done since canceling Firefly in 2002, but one of the worst things ever to happen in the history of television. Those people would be dead wrong. This is a cultural triumph, a magisterial montage of brash American competitiveness and oily British class deference, our two great nations brought together in a glorious pageant of crass misogyny that somehow... I'm wrapping up here, that somehow manages to make you lose more hope in the future of humanity than either could have achieved by itself. So yeah, that is one of the things that's happening here. Teresa Kramer, I'm going to make you start us out here. But one of the things that is happening here, I think, is, well, two cultures looking at one another. But that may not be where you want to go right away with.
Well, okay, so the thing I don't understand about the show, it's self-aware. I feel like it knows it's disgusting, and it's sort of it's trying to be disgusting in a way that makes us all pay attention to it because it's the summer and we're not watching TV. And I don't understand how it's going to sustain itself over a season, because I feel like by the second episode, anyone who hasn't figured out that he's not Harry is just, you know, not mentally competent to sign a contract with these, you know. He looks more to me, he looks like some sort of creepy hybrid of William and Harry, if anything, and or maybe like their bastard brother that no one knows about.
Harry Snow on Game of Thrones.
Exactly, he's the Jon Snow of the family.
We have to say that some of these women are pretty clueless. One woman sort of says she doesn't really know who Prince Harry even is, right?
Or she doesn't know.
She have
no
particular
like,
mental image of Prince Harry. So,
but I feel like one of them made a joke about Las Vegas and his shenanigans in Las Vegas. Am I making that up?
No, because I haven't memorized.
Okay.
And Jim watched it three times.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have some vague understanding of what he looks like. And I understand, like, you may not follow the royals in any sort of way, but Harry is kind of the cuter one. If you do pay attention, you probably know what he looks like. And they obviously know what he looks like enough to make a connection between the two. Mm-hmm. But the whole thing is just gross.
So we may not be that well poised to judge this because we don't watch enough reality television to compare it.
Oh, wait.
Well, I have in the past.
You have in the past. All right. And I just want to say also, if you're out there, if you're listening, if you've actually seen this show or can't believe we're talking about it, 860-275-7266. That's the number to call. 860-275-7266. So you said, whoa, whoa, whoa. Is this the death knell of civilization?
No,
is
this the most morally bankrupt? I am fully pro stance on this. I am so into this show. First of all, I felt a little abandoned when Downton Abbey ended. So now here comes my new Downton Abbey. And it has complete with the British butler, Cato, who I thought was fantastically cast. He's a real guy. And I think it's amazing that Harry would do this philanthropic adventure on American television and sort of put himself in this position of vulnerability.
You were fooled. Well, you know, it is similar to Downton Abbey in the sense that on Downton Abbey, Shirley MacLaine and Paul Giamatti, they are exactly these crass Americans who come over not to the manor born, not knowing the ways, kicking all kinds of tripwires, and sometimes being a little bit more authentic.
So it's much more highbrow than you guys are giving credit for. Secondly, I think that going to Miss Porter's school and cherry-picking these women was a fantastic idea.
Please choose your verbs more carefully.
Hand-picking is worse. Picking these highly erudite, educated women. And secondly, from a business standpoint, there's a spin-off waiting to happen. And that is, I think her name is Tiffany. She's clearly an alcoholic because early on states,
Maggie.
I have to drink because my whole family drinks to have a good time, and I love to drink.
She's going straight over to the show Intervention.
A new show. She's going to get Royal Rehab because she's going to win Harry, after she barfs on his tuxedo, having had 17 royal teenies that she starts out with, the first sight she's like guzzling alcohol.
Everybody's pathologies are on full display.
It's really amazing. It's astonishing. So I was disappointed after watching it four times that there wasn't another episode. And the other thing is, this now elevates Snooki to being our new Dorothy Parker.
Yeah.
Such a low bar that that the Jersey Shore now becomes Downton Abbey of America.
And Benny Hill is now Alistair Cook. So,
that's right, right. Or H.L. Mencken.
You know, but Rand, I don't know. In some ways, I feel like, I mean, I don't want to try to force you into the role of actually trying to deconstruct this show, which I'm sure you completely loathe.
Come on, you sea
donkey. And resented being forced to watch. But there are some interesting little things going on in the show about people's perceptions of one another across the Atlantic Ocean, right? I mean, this we should say this young man, Matt, who is pretending to
wait,
be
wait,
Harry.
Wait, Harry.
Yeah, Harry. Pretending to be Harry. Faux Harry, we'll call him.
Don't ruin this for me, Colin.
Faux Harry, you know, seems like a nice enough lad. And he's intrigued and a little bit repelled by these American women who are disproportionately, I think, loud and over made up.
A bit forward.
And so, I don't know, are they playing around with some interesting cultural stereotypes? Or do you refuse to use the word interesting
well,
at all in connection with this?
I'm not sure that I have the tools in my toolkit to find a way to appreciate anything about this show. But I'll note a couple of things. First of all, it's interesting to me that they're in some ultimate sense, it's not entirely clear what the stakes of this show are because they're fudging necessarily the question, Jim's response notwithstanding, of whether anyone could possibly believe that this is even women as benighted and limited and impervious apparently to any kind of news in the world as these women are.
He has a helicopter.
He has a helicopter, but you know, of course,
a manor house
and a butler,
and obviously. The faux Harry is in this for some sort of stakes, and he keeps saying, "You know, I hope at the end of this somehow I will come out with a true relationship with someone." And so it's actually, which seems highly highly unlikely since the entire thing is based on deception. So it's actually not at all clear to me what these people think in a fundamental sense they're doing there. That said, I will say I had two glimmers of sympathy. And then a moment of interesting blank horror. And the sympathy was one when Harry, the faux Harry, expresses nerves about, oh, he has to perform. There's this interesting way in which it's not just Americans meeting.
I think all men have that.
It's not just Americans meeting Brits. It's divisions within British society. And the fact that this faux Harry, Matt, is not a posh tough, but just like a regular guy. He's even a trace of a Cockney accent. He has to go through a whole Pygmalion-like training in which he learns to ride horses and play polo, and he doesn't know what the proper silverware is. So as much as there's this American-British class clash, there's this British-British class.
But that scene, they treat him like he was raised in the woods by wolves and like he doesn't even know what a fork is. What is that?
Well, no. He knows what a fork is, but they have a series of goblets and glasses and they ask him what this one is. He says, oh, shot glass? And so he has to be trained.
And then they shock him.
And the butler has this mixture of disdain and reticence under a guise of absolute respectful service. But the other moment of sympathy I had was with one of the – is it 12 women?
Yes.
There's one woman among the 12 who, as she watches all the others doll themselves up and make these scurrilous, nasty comments to each other and about each other while smiling, she's sort of bewildered and says, oh, I don't know how to do this.
She says, I don't know what bronzer is.
And she's the one out of 12 who betrays some sign of awareness, of thoughtfulness, and apparently, I guess she's the first one who's booted out.
So spoiler.
They absolutely purify the bimbo pool.
Well, from a production standpoint, I was thinking she would have been the one you want to keep on the show to point
absolutely.
Out the ridiculousness.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, okay, if you were planning to watch this show, we're going to be talking a little bit about the girl who gets eliminated here. So, you know, put your fingers in your ear and go, woo, woo, woo. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, her name is Leah. And in many respects, and we're going to play a clip from the show in just a second so people can get the fascinating sound and feel of the show. But in many sense, I totally agreed. Mm-hmm. I thought, how are they going to keep her in the mix all the way to the end without it becoming obvious that this beautiful but kind of awkward, self-deprecating young woman is obviously the fairy tale ending, the fairy tale ending for Harry. By the way, the faux Harry, Ray, and one thing that I was sort of thinking is even before the faux Harry, gets all this tutoring on how to be a high-class toff. Mm-hmm. He's already, compared to all of these women, basically Sir Kenneth Clark. I mean, he's like a conservative. His manners are already a lot better than –
one of the things I was thinking is that this sort of stereotype we have – I mean, obviously, when we're talking about the upper class English, they're better than us, let's be honest. But we were talking – my family is English, and these people are not quiet, and they are not
right. –
you know, they do their fair share of drinking, and they're basically Australians let loose in Britain. But so it's sort of a stereotype that in a lot of ways doesn't even exist anymore, because I'm a much quieter person than any of my British relatives for the most part. But they've just – cherry-picked everyone, as you've said, and Colin has admonished us not to use that word.
Well, I think there's a number of stories they're telling. But before we get any further, let's just for people who are just really feeling like they're missing out on all this, here's just a quick clip from the story from the show. I'll set it up a little bit. This is one of the girls who's introducing herself, and she's the one who is implausibly a molecular biologist.
Pre-med, cell and molecular biology, the interest in ophthalmology.
Bitch. I don't see the other girls as competition. I'm smart, I'm funny, I'm beautiful. I'm the package deal. And a lot of these girls don't have anything.
This is what it's all been building up to. I get mistaken for Prince Harry almost every day, and it can be disappointing when girls realize that I'm not Prince Harry and then they show no more interest. This is my chance to actually be him and see if I can find someone I never would have met otherwise. I don't know if I can pull this off. Or what have I got myself into?
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Teresa, once again, making you the spokesperson for young women of, you know, a generation or two, you know, one of the depictions of American life that's sold in this series is one of depravity isn't quite the right word, but you. I mean, for example, this young woman, Leah, as each woman walks into the first night, this glorious night of dancing one by one with Harry, he kisses each one on the cheek. And she says afterwards that it's so nice to be kissed on the cheek, that usually she meets men in bars and they just make out with her in the back of the bar at the end of the evening. Nobody ever kisses her on her cheek. There's another person who's just very almost overwhelmed by the idea that there's a tea party, that they're going to all sit around and drink tea, that this is just – you know, this is the most exotic and formal thing in the world. And I mean, they're clearly selling us on something. I don't think it rings particularly true.
Well, yeah, there were a lot of, you know, when they, I don't know what they call them, or the one-on-one camera interviews where they're saying things where I'm like, well, a producer has clearly just asked them a question to elicit a response to make her look stupid, or to make her sound more overwhelmed by a tea party. I mean, a tea party, it's basically a bridal shower. I mean, they've all been to one. Like, it's not that much different. They're impressed by cakes, apparently. Like, they're not animals. Long Island isn't, you know, Montana. They've seen these things before. So some of the production value, if you're paying enough attention, I feel like you're going to see the producers prodding them to sound a little bit dumber than they really probably are.
I mean, it seems like all of these shows are – they're trying to show us something that we want to see. And with this one, I was trying to parse it. I was trying to figure out what is it that they're trying to entertain me with. You know, is it just a repulsion against women from my own country?
Well, you know, one thing they did with our faux Harry, the hero, the prince of our story, he ends up choosing this sort of
dreadful person,
Madonna horror girl, who is I teach little school children, but check out my panties, and so. He falls prey to, well, aren't you a bit forward? But turns out Harry likes him a little forward,
right?
Well,
one of the things I was thinking is that he seems a little weird to me. He's kind of awkward and quiet, and he's not a bad-looking guy, and he says no women will go out with him. And he claims to his real-life profession is cleaning up oil spills, which, I mean, is a little gross, but it's also kind of environmentally friendly, and he could get away with it. And I don't see... So I feel like whatever issues he might have with women, if they're true, they may just be, you know, played up for the show, are because he's a little quiet, a little reserved, a little awkward. And that if a woman isn't willing to just, like, throw herself at him, he's never going to make a move. So without these women, nothing would ever happen.
Either that. Rand's going to have the last word on this, but either that or one of the things I assumed was they were suggesting, well, if he's going to order from the American menu, he wants to order a very American dish. Mm-hmm. So he orders this very loud
hope she's from Texas.
Much louder than we would assume any British girl not related to Teresa Kramer by blood would be. Anyway, Rand, you get the last
there,
word.
There are, there are certain basic themes of American life that we ourselves cherish and that continually fascinate and sometimes mystify people from other countries. And some of them have to do with independence, the notion of the self-made person, and the pervasive salesmanship of American life in a sort of death of a salesman way. American forwardness is not just a matter of personality. It's also a matter of function in a society in which, in a highly mobile society in which people have to sell themselves constantly. It strikes me that what these reality survivor-like TV shows do is take that to the level of absolute farce in which there's no camouflage, there's no subterfuge, and these underlying themes of American self-salesmanship are made so extreme, and it's proper that we have a properly reticent faux Harry on the other side of things.
I mean, I just watching the show, I was recalling last August, I was checking out of a hotel in Amsterdam just as some Americans were checking in, and they were so awful, you know, in every possible way. They were awful and paranoid and pushy. And, we have all had those moments, too, where you want to run over to the concierge and say, really, this is not us.
And that's why I think it was brilliant for them to eliminate Leah, because as you said, Leah is the only one who has skepticism and a level of irony. In that way, she represents us in that group. She's our foothold. When they eliminate her, after that, it's just, an American skanky in Prince Harry's court.
And that's
all that's left. And you feel horror at that.
You just elevated the whole thing to Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah. No, he got Arthur Miller into it. That was very impressive.
Arthur Miller. I mean, it's highbrow. It's highbrow stuff here.
All right. We have to move on. Okay, so there's another way in which we saw two cultures clash this weekend. It was a much darker portal through which to look, and that was the story of six young people in Iran who made this adorable video of themselves dancing to the Pharrell Williams omnipresent hit, Happy, something that he's encouraged people around the world to do as just sort of a way of spreading good vibes, make a video. It turns out in Iran, it's against the law to feel like a room without a roof. And so they were actually arrested and mistreated, I think it's fair to say, or at least by our standards, mistreated. And so they spent parts of three days in jail. They were released. Their families have to pay fines of roughly $10,000. They had to apologize somberly on Iraqi state television for doing this. And one of my reactions was just a feeling of kind of powerlessness. I was thinking, this is so wrong, but I don't get to have any say in this unless I can get anonymous to do a site attack on the Iraqi website.
But that's what's happening, I think. Isn't Iran like 65% young progressive people? There's this ruling kind of class that eventually is just going to get nudged off the top. And these people represent what maybe Iranians really are, which is probably regular people who want to have an internet and want to be happy. And they don't want to have to wear burqas. And I think that was one of the offenses, is that the women did not have their heads covered.
The hijab, yeah. They were not wearing the hijab.
So do not be happy with your head uncovered. But if they were sad with their head uncovered, maybe that would have been acceptable. But didn't the Ayatollah tweet, or the president tweeted, like, hey, we can't be too hard on people who are finding joy in wherever they're finding it.
Yeah, President Hassan Rouhani, his official Twitter feed said on Wednesday, hashtag happiness is our people's right. We shouldn't be too hard on behaviors caused by joy.
That's a big change. Yeah. He has Twitter, right.
He knows hashtags. But Rand, once again, just to go back to I think as we were emailing back and forth about these stories over the last couple of days, you also sort of set this up in a very kind of interesting way as sort of, a moment where two cultures kind of compare themselves to one another.
When I watched it, I was surprised at the sense of joy that I felt. And I thought, this is the most hopeful thing I've seen about Iran in a long time. Part of that response arises from what Jim referred to. Iran is a very interesting country, and it has a very large, highly educated civil society and middle class. And unlike, for instance, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, Iran really arguably is waiting for a very interesting evolution toward much more liberal values, but it is being held back by this claque of very rigid theocrats that is also represents an important strain in the society and is a direct result of 1979, the revolution. So when you see this, and I also felt the video itself, by the way, was just charmingly innocent mm-hmm. and exuberant. And I mean, it sounds silly to say, but I watched it and I thought, oh, you know, these people in circumstances in which it's not without a cost are taking the risk to just have what we in the West would consider a normal good time together. And I was very impressed by that. And I think if you look back to 1979, which three of the four of us are old enough to remember, and the harrowing images that are the legacy of that time and you know the just totally comprehensive rancor that existed between the two countries. And now you flash forward to this, where a certain kind of social and cultural good that the West has developed is something that is in a quite lovely way coveted by the average middle class Iranian. I just found it really very hopeful.
It's kind of a little bit like the end of the movie Fargo, at least Argo, although they should be playing as a double feature as in a studio, Argo and Fargo. But at the end of Argo, you know, they have this conversation. I mean, it's completely fictionalized, but there's a conversation in the airport where they sort of storyboard the movie that they're working on, and suddenly these, you know, formerly hostile security guards are kind of interested in this Canadian/American movie, and they have some questions about it and stuff like that. I mean, we do have this sense anyway that our culture is so appealing that it might triumph over even mullahs.
Clearly they haven't seen Do You Want to Marry Harry?
Right.
I'm sort of hoping this leads to the Footloose Rebellion, because clearly they have not seen what happens when you try to repress dancing and singing. But I have this idea of like flash mobs of people just in the streets dancing and singing, and you can't arrest them all, and hopefully it leads to something bigger.
All right. Yes.
Well, when the president is, as you said before, when the president is tweeting and retweeting a post on the same social media that pervades this good in the first place, I mean, the battle seems to be maybe two-thirds over.
I mean, he basically tweeted like, yo, chill, right. You know, let's all party.
Certainly the PSYOP's move next is to airdrop as many of those Pharrell Williams hats into the country as possible.
The CIA is working on that
absolutely
now.
Maybe they did this.
Yeah, they can't make them fast enough. Yeah. All right, we got to take a break here. We're going to come back with a story about literature with your burrito. Huh, because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm happy. Clap along. So here we are. We're back. So I was thinking of asking at one point. We had like a little debate even while we were doing this segment, because Kion had picked up some other music to end the segment with, and I was typing in, well, you know, what if people haven't heard Happy? And Betsy typed back, everybody has heard Happy. And I was thinking, I bet you there are people in the audience. I don't know how that they would have succeeded in not having heard the song Happy, but there are people in our audience who haven't. Well, it turned out until we started working on this, Rand hadn't heard Happy. So, and Rand's a pretty happening dude. So,
and happy.
And I'm very happy now.
Yeah, right. So if you had never heard Happy before this, please email me at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org, and tell me how that was possible, how you managed that, because I've heard it 750 times, and I still like it.
Today.
What was really probably annoying was, as we were working on it, and yesterday we were sort of all emailing back and forth and talking about this particular thing, and I realized I was singing it, and I'm sure Mr. Dankosky and I share a wall that does not go all the way to the top, and I'm sure he's thinking, what a jerk, he's going to sing that Pharrell Williams song all day. All right. It does get stuck in your head.
He doesn't have mean thoughts like that.
It's an earworm. He doesn't. All right. So in this segment, we want to talk a little bit about an idea that the Chipotle grill chain has come up with, in which it was actually shopped over to them by Jonathan Safran Foer, which is kind of interesting because he's sort of so opposed to eating meat and stuff like that. But
I was on that show.
You were on the Eating Meat show?
Yeah. You had me do an essay for that show.
Oh, really?
I talked about killing deer.
It's all a blur to me. Everything that's happened in the last 5 years, it's just like life in a Turkish prison. One day melts into another.
Just call him Ivan.
But I'm sure that was the case. But we did, yes. So Jonathan Safran Foer comes to them, and he has this idea of having literature on their bags and cups. And so they do this They include 10 different writers, and the word writer is kind of stretched pretty expansively. Sarah Silverman and Bill Hader are not really noted writers. But, you know, there's one Nobel Prize winner, Toni Morrison, some deep thinkers like Steven Pinker, and a pretty impressive overall lineup. George Saunders, he's very happening right now. And so there are these sort of two-minute prose pieces on the bags and on the cups. Well, I don't know even where to begin. Actually, I thought Rand was going to hate this idea, but you actually like it.
Well, you were right in that I approached it with great suspicion. And then I tried to figure out, well, what am I suspicious of? Well, first is I thought this is some form of advertising. The relentless effort in America to put advertising everywhere into bathrooms. You're standing at the urinal. There's something that you're now reading. I thought, okay, now they're even getting into coffee cups and bags. So that was part of my suspicion. The other part is, this is continuing the marginalization of literature and the attenuation of the attention span. So now literature is now reduced to something you can read on the side of a coffee cup. So I had all of these hostile, skeptical, suspicious, and wary approaches.
It's just really small print.
But then when I got down to it, I liked the way the cups looked. They showed on the video clip the woman designing, and it's sort of done in a loopy handwritten style, a little bit like Matt Groening, the old Life is Hell stuff. And then I thought, okay, look, if you can get Steven Pinker with his theories of mind onto a coffee cup and have someone read a two-minute condensation of Steven Pinker and Jonathan Safran for a person whose motives have got to be considered practically chaste, this is a good thing. And so I'm totally ready to sign off on it. I just wish that they would allow some non-famous writers to at least submit something to it.
Maybe they'll have fill-in cups and a pen. You can ask for a crayon
It'll be like those New Yorker cartoon caption things that I hate so much.
Right, right.
You can complete the essay that's on the back. Right. Well, first of all, Teresa, as our burrito expert also, one thing that you said is you have some hesitation in going to Chipotle, because of the literature that's on the back.
Exactly. So from a purely marketing standpoint, this is kind of genius because I will go to Chipotle now just to check out the cups because I am very much more pro Moe's. They do a better job of wrapping their burritos and they have a wider selection of things to put in your burrito, and that's very important to me. And so I will definitely – probably this weekend even, I'll probably skip Moe's and go to Chipotle.
But you feel that Chipotle burritos are not wrapped
they are not structurally sound. They do not – they fall apart in your hands when you're trying to eat them, whereas the Moe's ones, like they really hold together. Clearly there's a burrito wrapping class happening for the Moe's employees. They just need to get that done.
Moe's is like a cast. You're buying an injured burrito and they're making it whole for you.
Yes.
And I hope Moe himself is listening because he could have cups too.
Yeah,
you know, or maybe
cups.
He could have entire dishes or walls.
You don't want to be the second place to do this, though.
I guess not. Well, he could go the other way.
Although one thing I was going to say is, and I'd love to hear anybody wants to react to this, one of the things I feel that's happening now, and I don't know how I feel about it, is there's this kind of attempt to commodify culture and then marry it up with something that you're going to eat. So you're at Starbucks and there's like a certain kind of CD that you can buy. And I always feel like there's like this stealth thing where basically what they're doing is what Amazon and iTunes do. If you like this, maybe you'll like that. If you like this, maybe you'll like that. Mm-hmm. You know, that I'm constantly – that my sensibilities are being anticipated.
That's just the
and
internet
joined to
being
another.
Made real right in your face. It's
right.
Clickbait right there at the checkout line for you.
So maybe they're going to match different writers to different kinds of coffee and bags to different – so if you're getting a chocolate chip cookie, you're going to get this writer. They have that figured out.
Steven Pinker's smarty pants.
Well, let's just spend a moment actually looking at actually what's on the bags and what's on the cup. So Steven Pinker, deep thinker that he is, wrote a very optimistic essay for this. It's a two-minute essay on basically why you should actually feel a little bit better about the world than you went into Chipotle.
That was the theme of his last book.
Right. He says, as it happens, the numbers tell a surprisingly happy story. We're back to Pharrell Williams. A surprisingly happy story. Violent crime has fallen by half since 1992. I think he means in the world. And 50-fold since the Middle Ages. over the – so someone is much less likely to kill you with a pike now.
Or a morning star.
Yes. Over the past 60 years, the number of wars and the number of people killed in wars have plummeted. Worldwide, fewer babies die. More children go to school. More people live in democracies, not Iran. More can afford simple luxuries. Fewer get sick and more live to old age.
So go ahead, pour more cream in me.
Well, one of the interesting ones I thought, the Jonathan Safran Foer one, just was like a string of questions. And it seemed like if you were sitting at your table at Chipotle talking to someone, you could just, you know, go back and forth with each other actually answering these questions that are a little bit weird, sort of probing. I don't know.
That's well, here's the one that I thought was the most off-putting, and it's the one by Toni Morrison.
She's off-putting.
Yeah. Even though it's kind of a brilliant little piece. It's not even 2 minutes long, no matter how slow a reader you are. But it begins. Imagine that you're eating. You've got your, a carnita burrito like halfway through and you're chewing it and you read, "I took my heart out and gave it to a writer made heartless by fame, someone who needed it to pump blood into veins desiccated by the suck and roar of crowds slobbering or poisoning or licking up the red froth they mistake for happiness because happiness looks just like a heart painted on a Valentine cup or tattooed on an arm that has never held a victim or comforted a hurt friend. I took it out, and the space left in my chest was sutured tight like the skin of a drum." Well, that's like great writing, but it's a little bit gross, too.
It's a little heavy-handed if you're just having a cup of coffee, right. I think, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing is Steven Pinker, I think, in his probing of the human mind, has decided that art and the expression of it is simply an aberrant byproduct. It's just something that happened. We don't need it. It's not necessary for human existence. And I was a big Steven Pinker fan till he said that. And now I get a little grousy when I see him pontificating with his curly hair and his cowboy boots.
My skepticism is beginning to surge back up.
There we go. That's it, you old sea donkey.
Maybe this is a way. This is a way to enable people who have never and don't intend to read the actual works of these people to be conversationally conversant. And you read one quote from Toni Morrison. Now you've read Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Pinker's commentary on the cup is a quite effective précis of his 700-page book. So,
let me see if I can get your skepticism going even worse. And this is like I'm now taking a stick and poking it into the tiger's cage. Come on, come on. Is there no part of you, Rand Cooper, that wishes that Toni Morrison said, "I'm a Nobel Prize-winning author. I am not writing something for your burrito bag."
I was just wondering how much they got paid.
Oh, wow. I was thinking they were doing it pro bono.
Well, it does advance their presence, right?
Right.
I was just thinking that, though, because I like Toni Morrison. I read her books. And if I read that, I would be like, who is this lady? I don't think, if I didn't know who
she
was.
She's cranky.
Oprah hadn't introduced her to me in, 1998.
We've got 3 minutes more to talk about this. I don't know if I gave out the phone number of the whole show, but it's 860-275-7266.
Maybe somebody has a mouthful of that.
860, yeah. Please chew and swallow before you
call. Malcolm Gladwell is one of them, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
860-275-7266. Yeah, I read most of them. My favorite, and he's so trendy right now anyway, was George Saunders. George Saunders was writing from the present to the future. And he writes – and he has this kind of staccato style of this particular piece that he says that he's got a name for it, that he works on this style a lot. But he's writing from the present as though he were some kind of primitive man writing to people far in the future. And he says, "No two future generations still have bosses, bosses still intrusive, still have offices, future offices equal high tech. All you have to do is think – raise temperature in office. Computer does. People move from place to place on invisible air cars. People think, air car, take me to copy room. Soon are soundlessly proceeding to copy room, except there is no copy room because paper obsolete. All documents projected onto screen inside brain. sometimes for prank. Future person sends ton of random copies into brain of friend. Friend cannot walk slash see. Has to feel way to air car. Say, air car, take me to Frank's cubicle. I'm going to kill Frank for flooding my brain with random copies. Well, he got me laughing.
You know who could have written that?
Who?
Colin McEnroe.
Well, possibly.
It's very McEnrovian.
That's probably why I liked it.
It's also interesting that that's on a paper bag.
Right. Because you have to engage with it. I mean, all of these things. I mean, the Toni Morrison thing, you have to engage with this.
Well, this is the other thing. It's an interesting, you know, literature, the purveyors and creators of it certainly hope that it's going to be timeless and undying. And they're printing it on paper that's about to be recycled. So it's sort of the meeting of the eternal and the throwaway. And there's a structural irony contained in doing this in the first place. That's kind of nice.
All right. Are we done?
You hear that, Mo?
I wonder how often they're going to change these out, actually.
Yeah.
Like, is it going to be an ongoing thing where they have to get a new crop?
Collect them, trade them.
Yeah. There should be a cereal
I'm going to have a Chipotle bag wall in my house.
I want the True Detective series.
I mean,
quotes.
It kind of is Happy Meals for, you know, Jeopardy players or something. There's, you know, it's like, save them all. All right, we got to take a quick break here so we'll have time for endorsements. So let's do that. We'll come back with endorsements.
I don't like burritos loose.
T-H-I-T-O.
I don't like burritos loose.
O-T-O.
I don't like burritos
loose.
It's my favorite food. I love Chipotle. It's all I wanna do. You could have a burrito, maybe three tacos, or throw it all in a bowl. I love Chipotle.
The Sarah Silverman burrito was delicious, but the Malcolm Gladwell taco was kind of stringy. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Josh Nalea and Lily Tyson. Katie Tolarski and Lydia Brown, Smartest Girl in America, trademark, appeared in our intro. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by The Dude. For show pages, articles, and the dreams of the Faith Middleton show staff transcribed onto a paper cup from Arby's, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday, enjoy your holiday with our show about the world's strongest librarian. And now, back to Colin.
You know, just to sort of wrap up the conversation we were having before, one thing that I did forget to bring up, and they talked about it on Slate Culture Gabfest, which I always steal ideas from, is, you know, that whole thing with the literature anyway on the bags and the cups. It is a little bit like the ambient culture that you sometimes see, like this, as somebody mentioned, the subway poetry in New York, which is really nice. You know, there's something kind of – that's a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm for it.
Yeah. And then as you pointed out, if people didn't look at these things on the bags at Chipotle, they would just be looking at their devices. And you and Philippe Petit are opposed to those devices.
And they're unlikely to be reading Malcolm Gladwell on their
right.
devices.
Right. Probably are. All right. So here we go. We're going to do some endorsements right now. Teresa Kramer, you go first.
I would like to endorse this week's episode of WTF with Marc Maron with RuPaul.
Hmm.
RuPaul was hilarious and touching, and there was a sort of controversial discussion of the word tranny and whether or not he finds it offensive, and he does not. And that sort of started a little internet uproar after that.
Okay, so first of all, we have to say, since we have people in the audience who have never heard happy, chances are, and you don't have to explain what WTF stands for,
okay.
But you could at least explain perhaps or help people understand what it is you're talking
about. It is a podcast by the comedian Marc Maron, who has a show on the IFC channel. So since you listen to NPR, you probably watch that and may have seen it. He just sort of interviews. He started out with comedians, but now he's running out of comedians. So there's actors and musicians and
I can't believe he's
drag queens.
About RuPaul about cars. That's
yeah,
weird.
That is very strange. But it's actually probably one of the best interviews you'll ever hear outside of, you know, Fresh Air. Even better, actually, because people get to swear and say all sorts of things they can't say on NPR.
I'm a lover of podcasts, and I cannot get into Marc Maron.
Really?
There's something about his overall self-presentation.
Well, he's sort of very anxious.
Yeah, there's something about him that I find off-putting.
It's sort of a schooled anxious thing. Like he's decided to be anxious. Mm-hmm. I think so. I think we're trashing Marc Maron.
Yeah, I know. I'm wrong about this.
Cry about
the show has. you know, so many admirers, and their admirers tend to be people who like a lot of the same things that I like. I don't mm-hmm. know why I have this problem, but I just can't.
I wonder if it's the interview in particular that you're listening to.
I don't know.
Because
I mean,
there are ones I really think I'm going to like Sarah Silverman, and I'm like, that was kind of boring. But then, like, RuPaul comes up, and you're like, this is awesome.
All right. I'll try it. I have to give Marc Maron one more 18th chance to make me happy. All right, Jim Chapdelaine, what do you have?
Second guard. Wait, first intros on this show. I'm going to fully endorse that forever.
To put this into context, about like once a week, somebody writes me an email. It's not the same person either every time. Somebody writes me an email, says they don't like the intros, they wish they would go away. And I put a lot of work into the intros, writing them. Kyone puts an amazing amount of work into performing and producing them, as do our accompanying players. And so, like, if people really didn't like them, if people, you know, 3-1 didn't like them, we'd stop doing them. So I asked that on social media this week, and it turns out that a lot of people like the intros.
All right. So Sunken Garden Poetry Fest, go to all of them, but the Shinolas are playing June 11th at the Hillstead Museum in Farmington. It's an early thing, so you can bring your kids. I plan to do Charge of the Light Brigade to the music of Happy. And there's
Half a league on.
Right. Yeah. Oh. Onward. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's a little book I got sidetracked with called Just Kids by Patti Smith.
Oh, yeah.
That is really a nice – it's a little gauzy, and but I really like her writing. It's very simple and to the point.
About her and Mapplethorpe.
Yeah. It tells the story of her and Robert Mapplethorpe to the background of all the sort of chaos that was happening in the early 70s in New York City.
All right. Rand Cooper.
My first endorsement is cultural. It's the Paradise City Arts Festival in Northampton. The next 3 days, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. It's on the fairgrounds right off the highway. There is a very, very large selection of artists and craftspeople, and it's very high quality. It's everything from furniture to yard sculpture to painters, excellent painters, among one of them, my sister, Carrie Jacobson, who's a very accomplished painter. They also have a food tent with delicious food. Ice cream and so on. So Paradise City Arts Festival, if you go online and find it, you can get discounted tickets. My second endorsement is horticultural, and it's a garden store and nursery that I, among the many in the area that I particularly like, and that's Muscarilla's. It's on Route 44 in West Hartford, sort of between Bishop's Corner and Mountain Road. I've done a lot of flower and garden buying at Home Depot and Lowe's, and that's good for a lot of things. But the suspicion you have that if you use your local garden store or nursery, it's going to be much more expensive is often not true. And Muscarilla's has a terrific selection. Their hanging baskets, flower baskets, are much, much better than at the big stores and no more expensive. They have a huge selection of annuals. They've got great trees and shrubs. They're friendly. They help you with whatever you need. Muscarilla's, it's really a fabulous nursery.
Other people are endorsing Logie's in Danielson for a similar reason. That's Wolfie's endorsing that. And I know certain people who cross state lines and go up Route 10 to Southwick, where there's this big nursery place where people get really cheap plants. Okay, I want to endorse, you know, I mean, everybody talks about the Gutenberg Bible, but does anybody ever look at the Gutenberg Bible? There are, I believe, 48 of them known to exist in the world. There's the so-called 42-line Bible is what the Gutenberg Bible is. Only 21 of those are complete. One of them is in New Haven at Yale University in the Beinecke Rare Book Library, where you can just walk in and look at the Gutenberg Bible, which, you know, I mean, since people mention it all the time and use it as an analogy and an idiom and a trope and stuff like that, you know, there's one right nearby. So go look at the Gutenberg Bible. And then so while you're doing that, well, you can make a day out of it. So I have a couple of ideas. One of them is to get a latte at Willoughby's. I love lattes, and I love the fact that each one of them is a little bit different too. Like, you know, no two places serve quite the same latte. And Jim actually caught me ordering a latte at Starbucks one time and made fun of me for it. But justifiably, yeah. You were standing behind me in line. I didn't realize you were there, and I was getting a skim latte, and you said, "Now we find out who people really are."
I ordered a caramel macchiato, so you should have stuck around. Yeah. You could have given it right back to me.
So I like to get all the different lattes. I'm a big fan of Cafe Sophia in West Harford Center, and Tassane, of course, they're great. They make great lattes, and they're all kind of different. I tried Daybreaks in Glastonbury this week. But Willoughby's really is pretty amazing. They're on York Street, and so maybe you get the latte and walk down to the Beinecke Rare Book Library, where you, of course, cannot bring the latte inside.
outside. Spill your latte.
On the Lincoln Rogue Bible. And then leave it there. If you walk back out and go down York Street, Rand could give you a better guide to Indian restaurants all around New Haven. But there's a – I discovered one on the last trip called Zoroka right down on York Street, which has been reviewed positively by Rand's colleague, Stephanie Lyness. And it's they have a great little sort of, you know, he's well. And so and they have a nice little sort of buffet, you know, the typical Indian lunch buffet. And it may not be, you know, haute cuisine, but it'll stick to your ribs and get you through the day. So that's my plan for you. Gutenberg Bible. Call ahead and make sure they're open. And Willoughby's Latte and Soroka Indian Food. Thanks to Teresa Kramer, Jim Chapdelaine, and Rand Cooper. We'll be back Monday. We're going to have, a rebroadcast of our conversation with a guy who has Tourette syndrome and to sort of cope with the energy that he has, became a bodybuilder and the world's strongest librarian.
When we're both 85, if I still am alive, then it's Harry I'm planning to marry.
Yes, it's Harry she's planning to marry.
I'm Kyone Wolf. Do the contestants really think it's Prince Harry just because the butler calls him sir? I mean, Katie, I can call you Pope Francis, but...
God bless you, my child.
Oh, thank you, Your Holiness.